morning, everyone, and welcome to the New Media Show. My name is Todd Cochran. Of course, I'm joined this morning by my co-host, Mr. Rob Greenlee. Good morning, Rob. How are you?
Doing great, Todd. It's great to be here again. It seems like, are we at like episode 54 or 55 now, something like that?
Yeah, 54 in this series, and I think this makes us 100 plus for the other stuff we did. So, we're trucking right along here.
Marching along. There's never too much to talk about, or we never run out of stuff to talk about, podcasting and new media. There's always something happening in this space, that's for sure. And it's great to be here. It's sunny up here in Seattle, so I'm sure I'm keeping up with you, Todd.
Well, it's been beautiful here in Hawaii this week. But I tell you, we've got a great guest with us this morning. And Philip, I'm not even going to try to pronounce your last name because I'll just slaughter it.
No worries. It's Phil Svitek.
So, good morning from AfterBuzz.tv, and you're actually in the AfterBuzz studios, so thanks for making the trek in this morning.
Of course. Thank you guys for having me.
Yeah, well, first of all, it'd be great to kind of get a rundown of the AfterBuzz kind of network and what you're doing there. I was just out there, meeting with you and getting a tour of your facility out there, and you're kind of out a little bit west of Burbank. And just why don't you kind of tell us what you guys do there? I know you guys are huge podcasters.
Sure. The idea started a couple years ago, started by Kevin Undergaro and Maria Menounos. And they were huge Breaking Bad fans at the time. And, in the early phase of Breaking Bad, there wasn't as big fandom that there is now. And they just wanted to talk about it. But there was no platform. And so they kind of came up with this concept of post-game wrap-up shows for TV shows. And, in late 2011, we just kind of dabbled at the concept and, did shows like Jersey Shore, Mad Men. And slowly it kind of grew and grew. And it's grown ever since into the snowball effect where lots of fans just appreciate what we do. And we've created this, it's almost like heroin to them. They just need to talk about their favorite TV shows. And so a couple of years later, we've got about 80 TV shows every week that we do, over 300 that we've covered, and we get a huge amount of downloads, 23 million a week. Our audio is the strongest, but we've been seeing an increase in video as well. So it's been really exciting. And, the fan letter, to me, the fan letters that we get, they're the best part of it because of how much people appreciate what we do.
80 shows a week. Holy crap. I just...
It's definitely a lot.
Yeah. So, are they all produced right there in the studio, or do you have folks exterior? How's that work?
Everything's in studio. So we have, we started with one studio, and we have screening rooms here, right at the facility for the host to watch. They watch right here, and then afterwards they go in studio and talk about it. And as it grew, we just had the one studio, and then we needed a second studio to accommodate all the shows. And about last year, Kevin and I decided that we need a third studio, which is actually documented on Maria's reality show, Chasing Maria Menounos, where, it was a big fight about finance in terms of can we have a third studio, but we ended up going with it, and now we have three studios that we can run. So within a three-hour time space, we can have nine shows as opposed to if we had two studios, it'd be only four.
Yeah, that's huge. And I think about doing three shows after shows right at, and it's not like if you're doing this in the morning, you have to do this in the evening. So you guys must be night owls around there, aren't you?
Yeah. Typically we tape from 6 PM West Coast time to about midnight. Luckily we get the East Coast feeds for most shows, but it's definitely a lot. And it's a lot of work for the host. Typically, you try to prepare as much as you can, but obviously they're watching the episode live. We try not to get screeners because we personally don't like spoilers. And so for the host, they literally watch it in 5 minutes up. They're talking, about the TV show. So they don't really have time to research. So it's their reactions to it.
And yeah, take good notes and everything while they're watching the show. It's really cool. Rob, they're doing something here that, the rest of us don't have to really be stressed out about, immediately. I know when Ryan Ozawa was in the early days of podcasting when Lost was on, and him and his wife were here in Hawaii, and they would, as soon as Lost was over, they would do their kind of after show, and this genre, they were very, very popular. They did really, really well with that show. And then, so I can see where this, especially when the fans can have like an after show, basically an after place to tune in. That's why it's AfterBuzz. So I don't think it works if you do it the next day. Do you have any shows that do it, you know, later, or are most of the shows just immediately following the whatever's been produced?
Most shows happen the night of. Sometimes we do it the next day. We found the ones, you know, there's a weird trend. Let's say it's American Idol. The shelf life for American Idol is very short.
Right.
But, you know, as we're finding out with shows like Orange is the New Black, you know, that are on Netflix, people can binge watch it. And so we try to do those as best we can. And we, you know, obviously we can't do, you know, 13 episodes all in one night.
Right.
So we try to do about 4 a week for those types of shows. And it ends up working pretty well because while most people can binge watch the show, it still takes them a little bit to go through an entire series for the season.
So obviously you see a huge spike in downloads the morning after the show, I would imagine.
Yeah, it happens that way, but sometimes it's the weekend. And, you know, Rob and I actually talked about this. It's interesting, you know, as I mentioned, American Idol would have a shorter shelf life, but a show like Breaking Bad can have an extended shelf life and still continue on, you know, years after. I still have friends that I know that are just getting into the show. And so if they're just getting into the show now, you know, as they're doing it, they might want to listen to this after show. In the case of, let's say, American Horror Story, it does a global cycle where it airs in the U.S., then I think it's Mexico and Germany and Australia and New Zealand. And so, you know, in the time of the premiere, we'll get a lot of downloads in America. And then as it transitions and premieres, let's say in December over in Mexico, it'll get downloaded there. And so, you know, it'll kind of continue its life, you know, as it moves globally.
Do you guys strategize then on... you know, if you know that it's going to be launching in Mexico this date or this day in Europe, are you guys strategizing then your front page layout based upon, you know, what's happening in those other markets? Or is everything kind of just reside on their normal show page? Or do you guys do any optimization like that?
We don't take full advantage of that sort of optimization. And the hardest part has always been, you know, tracking the premieres just in general. It's hard enough alone in terms of America knowing when things premiere. We're still actually waiting for the cable lineup for the fall, which has been, you know, an unfortunate night, you know, because we're so dependent on the TV shows, it's a nightmare to schedule in that respect. But we have worked well with iTunes, and I believe they have 23 regions globally where they promote to. And so if we know it's, you know, about to premiere in the region, we'll, you know, hit up iTunes and they'll help promote it in that region.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, that's smart.
So have you guys ever built out, you know, like a community discussion area around a show that would be more written form as well, you know, in supportive of the podcast or of the shows?
We don't have an official forum, but because we're also on YouTube, you know, a lot of discussion happens there. iTunes is more for the, obviously, general feedback of the show, whereas YouTube tends to be episode specific, and a lot of people get into that, and we've seen the comments really grow there, and we've always encouraged our hosts to get behind it and answer as many questions as they can. I mean, there's definitely more and more, so I don't know if they can keep up with every single comment, but it's certainly been growing in that way, and it's fun to see.
With having three live studios, and I'm assuming they're all live, am I correct in that?
Yeah, so we stream live, and then after the fact, you know, within a couple hours, it's posted to iTunes in audio format, and then, you know, YouTube via video.
You know what, you know, Rob and I have been talking about this for a long time, and it's well known that we know, and you mentioned it at the beginning, that audio is still the strongest on your guys' side, and it didn't really make sense. You know, people are, and the next morning, they grab the, you know, they could get up in their player and listen to it maybe on the way to work or in, you know, on mass transit or however it may be. So I understand the audio being one of your strong points. But you said that video is growing. How are you seeing the, you know, kind of what's the curve on that?
It was a slow build, but now in the past couple of months, let's say, I think, you know, you mentioned it before we started the show that you saw us over at CES.
Right.
And Maria Menounos was the entertainment ambassador. And so I don't know if that kind of had a lot to do with it, but there was a lot of press about us at that time. And I think perhaps those people watch video more. And so, you know, word of mouth just kind of spread that way. We also did some new strategy. We, you know, we worked with YouTube a little bit to see what things we can improve upon in the video portion. And so, you know, we've just been taking that to heart and implementing it slowly and surely. And so I would say 2014 has been the year that everything's really taken off in the video end.
If you don't mind me asking, what did YouTube tell you to do?
Just small strategies, down to things like labeling the videos, how to better use tags. We're taking more advantage of the annotations, and things of that nature, you know, seeing when people get off videos. And so that way we can suggest other videos to them at the time that, you know, they may be trailing off. So that way, at the very least, even though they go to another video, they're still on our videos. We've also kind of extended a lot of our content. We now have a much bigger red carpet presence. In fact, we have a ton of people over at Comic-Con. And so we're also uploading content outside of just our after show, you know, stuff that it lives exclusively on YouTube.
Right. So you're going out there and getting that content that keeps the, basically what you're doing is you're feeding the fans on off podcast days.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it's a big strategy I've always promoted. And I have statistical data that shows that, and I've kind of been promoting this since seems like God was a child, that basically is, if you're blogging and doing extra stuff during the week when there isn't a show, people are going to keep coming back and eyeballing your site.
Yep.
And it keeps, you know, it keeps your show in the forefront of their mind. Which is really, really cool. Now, in you guys' studio setup, then can I ask what kind of infrastructure you guys use? You guys using TriCaster, Wirecast? What are you guys using back there?
Yeah, it's all TriCasters. We did research early on, and you know that was the one thing that made sense. We looked at the Blackmagic ATM TV studio, and it might have grown, but it's still not where the TriCaster is for us.
Yeah, that's
do that,
and that's what I use here. I use a 860 from New Tech as well. So,
plus Todd, they're all. Go ahead. Yeah, Todd, I was just going to say, and plus they're also big PowerPress users too.
Well, I'm glad of that. I'm glad you like to plug in.
Exactly. We worked with you guys to create the taxonomy podcasting.
That's right. Yeah, you guys actually. Just have to say they sponsored that. So. And we got some new stuff coming. I'm really excited in 6.0. We already kind of showed our hat a little bit. I don't want to diverge too much from the topic here, but we're going to have the WordPress playlist are going to be implemented, and we're even doing some really cool stuff for SEO. So this is the first time we've focused on SEO for a release of PowerPress, and I think people are really going to be ecstatic about it. We've talked with the Apple folks and a variety of people, and I think that, for me, is the most exciting thing that we're probably going to do on 6.0 is tackle SEO lightly, but it's still going to give people some options, which we think are going to be good. So going back to, and looking at you guys' website, when I look at the website, but a lot going on here. You guys obviously have your own app for both the Play Store on Android and also on iOS. And I think that's smart. Rob and I are going to talk about the Android thing a little bit later today in the show. And you got your schedule up, which I think a lot of shows need to do, which most don't. And, of course, some live videos or the recent video stuff. But one thing I do notice that's missing from the front page that I normally see on other pages is no sponsor banner. So you knew this was coming. How are you guys paying for things now?
We were very strategic, especially early on. You know, like I mentioned, Maria Menounos is a co-founder, but for the early years, we kind of stayed away because we didn't want to tarnish her brand. We really wanted to hone the product and things like that. And so same thing with advertisers. You know, we've been approached even early on by advertisers, but we didn't want to do it. We wanted to have the product where it needed to be. And now working with Rob's company Podcast One, now we're finally starting to monetize through advertisers. So we have advertisers in the shows, but not an official sponsor that we promote on the website and things like that.
That's interesting. I'd be curious to see how that works out for you guys, where you don't have anything specifically on the on the website, but within the shows themselves. How's your live audience then? Is your live audience, you know, for me, it's, I kind of laugh because, you know, I do a show here in Hawaii and usually everybody's asleep when I'm recording. And this morning show, it's a Saturday, so not a lot of people tune in. But, you know, when we post the show, we get, on both shows, we get, you know, great audience participation and downloading and viewing the show. How's your guys' live?
The live to me, I joke about it, but I, you know, we have over 200 hosts, and to them, it's like a vanity thing. You know, they love the live aspect of it. I joke about it because, you know, just like you, there's not a lot of traction with it.
Yep.
In that significant way, but you know, it's still nice for the people that are there because, you know, you're rewarding the hardcore fan.
Yeah.
They get to participate within the show via chat, and you know, sometimes they can call in if they want to. So it does work out in that sense, and you know, perhaps it will grow, but it hasn't really been a focus. It's just a nice novelty that we have on the website.
You know, Rob, there's some parallels here, man. It's just like the story is the same almost in many cases, isn't it? We're hearing the same thing.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I mean, we've known this for a long time, and I think it totally makes sense because it's people's schedules. This is an on-demand medium. People consume it when they can, not on a schedule, and that's the transition that new media is. You know, that's what new media brings to the table to people that love content, is the ability to control when they get it.
You know, I had a call yesterday from a gentleman who has a pet network, and he's not a podcast network. He's one of these live audio streaming networks, and he had his schedule up there, and you know, he was talking to me about their schedule, and I kept telling him, you know, he was looking at podcasting. He didn't have a big depth of knowledge on it, and he was going through the whole thing, and he said, well, you're live streaming. I said, no, this is on demand. It's just like your DVR. You get to watch stuff. Well, I don't have a DVR, and I'm like, oh my, okay, here we go. But anyway, it was basically, I had to go through and explain to him, you know, the trend and how people today are using media. And of course he's, you know, saying, oh my God, no one's, you know, we've had a drop in terrestrial. We've had a drop in, you know, people listening to our stream. And I'm like, yeah, because there's a lot of options out there. And we had quite the discussion, and he's got a lineup of 20 or 25 well-known people that are in the, I guess for a better word, animal industry. And the content they have is followed, but they're losing traction. And he kind of assumed, without knowing very much, maybe because of podcasting. And I thought that was interesting. But I don't remember the last time I actually, besides maybe sitting here and kicking up Pandora or something, I don't think I've ever listened to someone's live stream, audio stream, you know, just click something to play to hear a, you know, content time and time again. I do everything on demand, and that's what we've been conditioned to because of the DVRs in our house. So I guess I'm preaching to the choir here.
I think the only things to survive in that live field would be sports.
Right.
Because, you know, it's something that, unlike a TV show, you can give spoilers away. But still, you know, if I know a spoiler, it can still be enjoyable despite that, even on demand. Whereas sports, if I know the result of a game, it's not fun, and I don't feel part of the moment. Like, I can change the outcome of the game by watching it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's been a lot of kind of experimentation in this area going back to the early days of podcasting, too. I know that here up in the Seattle area, there was a content a network. It was called Buddy TV. And they were doing a different kind of a model here. They were doing it where they would have hosts host the show, their show, while the actual TV show was being broadcast. So the host would actually comment, you know, and have a discussion about the show during each commercial break. So it was kind of a different model. So there's been a lot of experimentation in this, you know, and my wife and I did a podcast back in 2005, and so, you know, for the Boston Legal TV show, and built a huge fan following around that show and a forum and all that kind of stuff. Back in the days when social media wasn't as big as they are now, but it's there has been a lot of experimentation. And like I told Philip when I was out there, that I always thought that there was going to be some network that was going to form that was going to do exactly like what AfterBuzz does, and just creates this huge community of people that that love TV shows and follow and want to discuss and talk about, you know, what's going to happen next week or what's going to happen to each character, and to speculate and all that kind of stuff. And there's also been a lot of, you know, official TV show podcasts that have been done by the big studios down there that have like producers and the actual actors from the program, and those shows tend to be a little bit more, you know, patting each other on the back, saying how great the episode is, and talking about very limited things around, you know, the actor's personal life. Where what AfterBuzz does is it's more from a fan perspective. They speculate. They talk about what could happen in the next episode, which is what fans want to talk about. But oftentimes, official podcasts don't go there.
Yeah, it is an interesting genre for sure. How are you guys doing? You know, you mentioned you guys are doing 20 million downloads a week. Who are you guys using to actually do your measurement on your shows?
We've been, you know, ever since 2012, we've been working with Akamai. You know, they've come on as a CDN, but back then we didn't even know necessarily what a CDN was. So it's definitely been a learning project for all of us here. But they've been very helpful in terms of all their new features, in terms of keeping stats, in terms of, you know, metrics. They also provide our live streaming. So they're the ones that we go to early on. They're, you know, because for us there was services we could pay for, but it was, you know, on a per podcast basis. And when you do 300 right. individual podcasts, the sheer cost to just basically track that is very high. And so it didn't make sense for us to do that. So
we ought to talk post show. There's a, you know, what we found, and you know, over the past couple of years here, is that even sometimes the CDNs are having challenges when it comes to the media on demand and being able to filter and stuff. But that's a whole different. A different topic. Very, very cool. So it's cool. You know, and basically you've got the performance on the downloads too, by using Akamai as a CDN. You don't have to, you've got that good, back-end infrastructure, and that's something that obviously that companies don't want to have to worry about. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that you guys are using PowerPress too. Are you guys running on your back-end, are you guys running multi-site, or does each of your shows have their own, install, or can you even share on that, on how your back end set up?
I think each show has its own install, I believe. And like I said, we're using taxonomy podcasting, specifically for AfterBuzz. You know, the shows are under a custom post type, and so that's why we needed to be able to have that ability. I know at the time when we were kind of working with you guys, it was category podcasting, I believe, is right? That's the term. But because it was a custom post type, it, you know, we needed to expand upon that infrastructure because it's not a straight post. And so, you know, that's how we use it. And, you know, we always turn on the advanced features anytime we start a new, you know, sort of podcast. And, there are some of our shows that are explicit, you know, every now and then. So, having the ability to do that on a per episode basis is always nice. Let's see. I'm trying to think of everything that we take advantage of. I mean,
you know, one thing I will say though is, if you are a podcaster and you're listening to this show, use taxonomies with caution, because it is a very complicated feature, and only people that know, you really have to know what you're doing, or you can really. It's not for the faint at heart, but used well, it works well.
Yeah, I mean, luckily so far we haven't had any problems, so
that's great.
Easy.
Yeah, well, knock on wood there.
Can you talk a little bit about the kind of like the show formats and what the thinking is behind that, and, you know, how your hosts, I mean, how many hosts that you have on a show, and what the dynamic is around all that, and how you guys think about it?
So each show has anywhere between two to four hosts. And, you know, they're all people within the industry here. Most of them are actual hosts. Others are writers, producers, directors, publicists. But first and foremost, they have to love the TV show that they do. So if I'm doing Orange is the New Black, I have to be a super fan of Orange is the New Black. As you mentioned, that's, you know, in order to have that fan speculation, I have to be a fan rather than, you know, a presenter or host of, oh, this is what happened on that episode. So we go into it thinking that way. We're always, for us, aware of an audience. We always joke about Kansas. You know, the person in Kansas, what do they want to get out of the show? And so we talk about that heavily, and especially when we do have guests from the TV shows on as guests, we make sure, what does the average person want to know? And rather than, you know, pat them on the back about what they're doing, we try to dive in and, okay, you know, what's the secret sauce of how you're able to make this scene or make this season, or what makes the show really tick? And that's kind of the principle behind it. And we, us as a staff, in terms of the intimate core that we have, we look at the hosts and the guests and the fans as, you know, guests of a restaurant. And so the hosts and the guests that come in here, if they have a good experience, they'll have a good after show. And by them having a good after show, the fans will love it. And so we try to have popcorn here. We try to have candy, soda, water, anything of that nature to make it, you know, the viewing experience as enjoyable as it can be. You know, our screening rooms are theater style. And so, you know, the better the experience, the better the after show.
That's great. So what kind of relationship do you guys typically have with the TV studios and the executives there and the marketing departments? Is there, are they starting to warm up and really embrace what you guys are doing as a terrific kind of marketing and fan building kind of operation?
Yeah, we've certainly been developing that in, you know, over the years. For example, Showtime has been great. Oxygen, a lot of the NBC net, you know, affiliates, and, you know, Stars, we just started doing a lot more Star shows. And so they've wanted to come on and do something more official. So right now it's been unofficial capacity in the sense that they send a lot of their guests to our show directly, you know, week to week. And, but now we want to do kind of something more official, but obviously keeping the spirit of what, you know, what all of this is.
Yeah, that's, you know, and two is, and I like the fact that you make the folks, or you're having the team screen the shows right there, and, you know, they can talk, and that's a big part of the success of a show, is they're probably, you know, they're chit-chatting back and forth and coming up with, you know, conspiracy theories or where are they headed next and all this stuff. I think that's a key to success with you guys, because I see so many of these type of shows that are not part of your network, that, you know, like there's two hosts in different locations and they get on, and I don't think it's as cohesive, but I think it really helps the, you know, because I've seen some of your guys' stuff. It really helps. And probably two is, you know, the show almost is almost built on the fly because of the background chitter chatter that's going on.
Absolutely. And the friendships that have come out of it, like I said, we have hosts, we have actors, directors. And so the synergy just outside of AfterBuzz that's happened because of it, it's amazing to see. And so, you know, people are now creating TV shows of their own that we've seen happen. And, you know, other projects, whether it's music and whatever else. And so that's really fun for us to see, you know, that kind of happy, you know, you can't necessarily put a monetary value on it, but it's kind of grown out of here from AfterBuzz with the friendships that, you know, the people have formed by sitting in room week to week with each other.
Right.
So do you see yourselves building a network that will do this for every TV show? And what's the kind of dividing line between what shows you guys do a show about versus ones that you decide not to?
We do it based on scheduling and kind of what, you know, host interest is. We try to cover as many shows as we can. The unfortunate part is, as we're learning more and more with fans, sometimes we're judged not necessarily by the shows that we do. So even though we do 80 shows, we're judged more on the shows that we don't do, which is more than 80, let's say. But we try to take fan suggestions now more and more. So they'll say, you know, hey, do Extant. And so, you know, we'll try to form a panel around that to make sure we cover it. So it's on a as best we can basis, you know, partly with what we know we need to cover, partly with what the host interest is and what the fan interest is. But it's there's no, unfortunately, exact science to it. We hope one day there will be, but so far.
Well, no. That and plus, I'm sure you'll need a much bigger studio to accommodate every show, right?
Yeah.
You know, I'm just amazed that you're able to juggle that many people. How many cross, you know, how many guests are on multiple shows? You know, you said 2 to 4 and you're doing 80 shows. Are you working with 150 people that are producing those, or how, what is your actual numbers?
We do have about 200 hosts in actual rotation, wow. But, you know, so some people will just do one show that they absolutely love, and that's the show that they look forward to, you know, every single season. But there's other hosts, let's say, you know, I'll give a shout out to Matt Lieberman, who, you know, typically does, let's say, 10 shows, you know, a week for us.
Right.
And so, you know, it varies, and it just depends on what the host, you know, wants out of it and what TV shows that they love.
Yeah, it just seems like, whew. I don't have to be the scheduling person that's dealing with that. Holy cow.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's and you're doing, you said how many shows in the evening? That you're doing 3 to 6 shows in the evening you're recording?
Typically, well, we can do, you know, we can, because of the 3 studios, we can do 3 shows an hour.
3 shows an hour.
Yeah. So each show gets about an hour time slot, ends up being about 45 minutes with the, you know, turnaround time and whatever else. But typically, you know, a light day actually for us is when we just do 10 shows. You know, normally we start to feel fatigue after 20 shows. But 20 shows to us could be just kind of an easy night overall.
All right. I just have to ask. So let's talk about the process here. When you're kicking that many shows, is it basically record, splice something on the end and exit and publish? Or you guys, when you hit record and hit stop, that's it? You can't be spending a lot of time editing. I can't imagine you are.
No, everything's done live to tape. And, yep, you know, we've built the philosophy around that. So all the hosts, you know, they understand that. The, yep, the staff understands that. So everyone's very self-sufficient in that respect, because we have that large amounts of people here. You know, people always know where they have to go. We have, I would think, pretty good systems in place. We're always trying to upgrade as we can, but, you know, people know where they're screening. People know exactly where they have to go into studio right after. And so it's almost a, you know, everyone's self-sufficient and, you know, everyone's just fast. Everyone's, you know, always on the go. And so after a show ends, you know, we try to upload it right after. And, you know, so that way, at the very least, the audio can be up within a matter of minutes. And then the video, once it, you know, fully gets processed through YouTube and all of that.
Yeah,
a lot of people running around efficiently in organized chaos.
Yeah, and lots and lots of upload bandwidth.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've got 4 separate internet lines, I believe.
Yeah, I'll bet. Yeah, so you guys mainly create your own shows, right? So you guys aren't necessarily working with too many outside shows at all that are not under the AfterBuzz brand. I know you guys are working on a few other projects. Can you share much about those?
Sure. You know, because of the success of AfterBuzz TV, we noticed that the urban community was a little bit underserved in the podcast market. And so we have a great host named Daryl Kristen, who always wanted to do something in that space as well. And out of that grew a network called Black Hollywood Live, which at this point has around 20 shows in sections such as fashion, music, legal, news, interview style shows. And so that's a network that's run out of here, but it's completely separate of AfterBuzz TV. So that was kind of the second network. And then, you know, most recently we just partnered with the SchmoesKnow.com guys, and, you know, they're all about movies. And so we dabbled with movies on AfterBuzz TV, but as the name suggests, AfterBuzz TV, we wanted to focus it on TV. And so we're creating a separate thing just for movies. Another smaller entity is called Book Circle Online, which is, you know, just people who love books. So we interview authors, we do book discussions. It's almost like an online book club. And then Maria's podcast we started a while ago called Conversations with Maria. We had to, you know, unfortunately put it on hiatus for a little bit because of, you know, a transition in Maria's career and, you know, she, when she was coming out with the book and things like that. So, you know, we're just taking what we learned from AfterBuzz TV and trying to apply it to these various verticals and expanding on them as, you know, fast as we can.
I got to ask, how many people you guys got working over there?
It depends on, you know, the network, but here at AfterBuzz TV, I would say the core group, that does the physical uploading, that does the prepping and all of that, let's say is, you know, about 15.
Wow. I'm, you know, that's, you know what that does, Rob? That makes regular studios and folks quake in their seats when they hear that this.
There's a lot of content being produced by 15 people.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
But also, it's another thing, too, is that the content is, you know, it's live. It's live to, you know, it's just like I do here. You know, I get done, I'm done. There's no editing. It's, you know, I encode it and upload it. So, you know, and a lot of people get wrapped around the axle about having to edit their show. And they spend, you know, 3-4 times as much time editing as they do producing, which sucks. So, you know, they've got great success over here with that model. And I think, too, is, you know, I've talked about this many times. Matter of fact, we just started a new show on Geek News Central. It's a elderly gentleman. He's going to be doing a show that's basically targeting people that are 50, 55 and over. Maybe even, you know, a little bit more to the right. And I told him, he's just doing audio. I said, you know, if you want to get better quickly, you know, put a video camera in front of yourself and then watch the video. And you, just by the simple fact that your mind is telling you I'm live, I have to make this right the first time. It makes you a better content creator to begin with.
It can be a little painful at the beginning, though.
But it's an ends to the means. It really is. You know, when I started doing video on this show at, you know, what was it, episode 600 or something, or on my Geek News Central show, it for the first month, I was kind of like, you know, then I really think it made me a better content creator. And you're forced to live with the mistakes, and you make them a couple of times, and you try not to make them again. So I'm just, what is your process then, Philip, on finding the right, the right people for the show, for the shows?
You know, at first it was referrals and friends, and then as it grew, we got, you know, actual applications onto the website, and now we get so many. So there's a full process of how we, you know, weed out the people that are right for the job and whoever else. But yeah, I mean, again, is there has to be a mentality to it. You know, I've met a lot of great hosts that, you know, as we say, sometimes are not AfterBuzz.
Right.
And it encompasses that mentality of, you know, this is new model. It's ever changing. So, you know, let's say all three of us come in studio today and whatever works, you know, that's what we're doing. But tomorrow, let's say we find out something new or something changes, we all have to adapt to that. And the people that don't, unfortunately, don't stick around here at AfterBuzz too long.
So do you find that hosts of the shows, I mean, especially ones that do multiple shows, do they build kind of fan base followings themselves, and listeners will gravitate to listen to a show on your network, or maybe even watch a show on TV because the AfterBuzz host is a host that those fans like to listen to?
Yeah, I wouldn't know how to track the statistic.
No, I'm sure.
Per se. I have gotten a lot of emails saying, you know, I started listening to AfterBuzz because of this TV show, and I fell in love with this host, and so now I listen to all their other shows. So that happens a lot with us, and it's great to see. You know, again, in terms of the actual statistic, I don't necessarily know, but certainly all the hosts' individual Twitters have gone up. It's, you know, for them, it's what they get in return. And, you know, the more that they're involved with the show, the better they are. You know, for example, when we first started Scandal, these hosts literally tweeted out to all the all the actors the next day saying, hey, here's the show. And slowly but surely, you know, they caught on. And now, you know, the Scandal people love us so much so that, you know, Kerry Washington always tries to promote a show, our show, as best she can.
Yeah, that's a self-fulfilling prophecy there. It's fantastic where you get the producers, the actors, everything to roll with the show. I mean, you just cannot buy that kind of endorsement / promotion / advertising, and it's free. You know, that is just holy smokes. It's huge.
Well, Todd, we should probably say that it's probably not entirely accurate to say that there's no post-production on these things, because I'm sure that there's T's-ins and exits and things like that they have to add post, right? Is that, or are they all produced on the fly with, you know, the intros and all that stuff? Can you
most
clarify?
Of us, as best we can, we try to keep everything kind of, you know, produced within the show.
Okay.
You know, you're right that there's a post tail end that's added for YouTube. Sometimes if there's different advertisers for the video portion versus the audio portion, you know, we'll take some certain stuff out to accommodate, obviously, as necessary. And so in that respect, you know, we have to do a certain amount. But as best we can, we try to keep everything as efficient as possible.
Because I know with Leo and his team, you know, he doesn't even record the intro until the end.
Yeah.
And to me, that's, you know, in my mindset, when I think about that, it's I'm just thinking about that guy that always has to take that and splice it and get it right in the, you know, the 2 minutes of extra work, you know, and it's, I hate to say it that way, but it really is kind of, you know, in the scheme of things, it's not a lot, but when you're doing 80 episodes a week, you know, that 2 minutes turns into true man hours.
And I think he, Leo does that because he doesn't actually always know where that show's, you know, high points are around topics and content.
Yeah.
So he doesn't know that till he just got done doing it.
Well, he also solicits the audience for the show title. So often
he doesn't
make them. The audience makes the title of the show.
Yeah.
So he's got
to. I think it's a smart approach. I think for what Leo, the type of content Leo does, I think it's a smart approach.
Yeah.
But it does add a layer of post production. You're entirely right.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of this live to tape and minimal post editing. I think, you know, I made a mistake. Really, you know, I got in the studio here a week or so ago and got everything fired up and hit record and hit stream, and I completely thrashed the intro to the, and so much so that I was laughing at myself, you know, right here in this chair. And those that were watching live probably got a kick out of saying, look at this idiot, he can't even talk. And it was so bad that I went in and redid the intro at the end. That's the first one I've done in years, you know, but I mean, I really thrashed it. It was bad, but you know, it is what it is. Most of the time you have to live with it. And, and sometimes I get grief for it, but, you know, time is money in this business, and you have to move quickly, and especially their content. And I'm talking like you're not here, Philip, but it's, you know, you guys are cranking so much stuff out, you have to be efficient.
Yeah, and you know, for let's say Black Hollywood Live, there's a lot more producing that goes into it, you know, especially if let's say we're doing a news story, or you know, let's take fashion, right? As they're talking about fashion, that tends to be a little bit more video heavy.
Yep.
So there's a lot of images that need to be rolled in, perhaps clips, audio. And so there's a lot more prep that goes into that. But that's, for me, I don't know, maybe it's just a choice. I'd rather put that time in the front of it, in the prep. And if everything's prepped 100%, then the show can be 100% smooth. Yeah, there may be a glitch here and there, but for the most part, the show itself can run very smoothly. And one of the things that, for me at least, that forces is communication. You know, if there's a lot of editing, then, you know, there's not that great sense of camaraderie, and people aren't talking as much. So, you know, the hosts and the staff, there's great synergy where they all have to be on the same page. And if, you know, perhaps we were doing a lot of editing, there wouldn't be that.
You know, I noticed you've got a mixer right beside your head. Is that a strategy that everyone can basically adjust their levels on the fly without having to yell at someone to turn my audio up?
Unfortunately, no. This is I'm in the kind of engineer section right here. We've equipped each engineer to have a headset so that way they can talk if necessary. You know, let's say if they need a live read needs to be tossed to them or anything of that nature. So right now I'm in the engineering section.
I got you. So that's your feedback loop back to the switcher. So in your back end team, do you have just one guy switching, or have you got a couple of people in the, you know, behind the camera, or how's that set up for you guys?
When the show starts, we have one person overall working the show. I mean, they'll get help, you know, at the start of it, just to keep things moving. But for the most part, it's one person per studio.
Is the and of course, Rob, you know, you got the opportunity to travel down there. Is the engineer right there, and you know, is the set right in front of them, or is the set in another room, or how does that work? So what I was referring to is, like, here I'm doing the live switching, and your guys' audience is the actual set.
Yeah, it's like a small little separate room.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah, because it's just, you guys must have a lot of space to support that many people. Or are you guys?
We've made use of the space, I would say. I don't know if we have the most space, but we've made use of the space that we do have.
Wow. Yep. No, they definitely have, you know, and their screening rooms have huge wall projectors. So those hosts that watch the show watch it online. I don't know. I mean, how big are your screens? They're like 120 inches diagonal or something like that. It's just huge.
Yeah, I know one of them's, I think, 19 feet diagonally.
Yeah. So.
it's definitely a fun viewing experience.
Yeah.
And do you normally have more people viewing the shows than you have they actually do it? Is that how it works out? Is that being a big party in the viewing room?
It can be, especially if there's guests. You know, the guests will bring their significant others, certainly their publicists. Sometimes, you know, family members of the host come in just to have fun. So it certainly gets to be a lot of fun that way. And then it obviously gets whittled down to the actual show in terms of, you know, you have the four hosts and the guests. But the viewing experience can, you know, again, it can be certainly fun.
I can only think of organized chaos upon the, and how many minutes do you go before you go live after shows went off? Is it like 5 minutes or something?
Typically, yeah. Sometimes, you know, with bathroom breaks, it's tough with the shows that don't have any commercials, let's say like HBO or Showtime.
Right.
Because the hosts have to go back to the bathroom right after their screening, whereas if there's commercials, they can do that in between the commercials. So, you know, it works out that way.
Wow, we're getting into the minutia now.
Rob, you know, the way I am, I would be like, they'd have to have soundproof rooms between the viewing room and the production room, because I'd be like, hurry up, hurry up.
Yeah.
Oh, it takes, you know, and you're trying to stay on time and everything else. I can only imagine it's just a little bit of organized chaos, but maybe not. But it's got to be exciting. Got to be fun.
It's definitely exciting, and it's fun to, you know, when you really hear people's reactions as they're watching the show, whether it's screams or moans, whatever, when they really get into those shows and there's the big surprises, that's fun to see. And then, you know, people are in the waiting room and they just hear a mass of people screaming. Everyone just turns their head like, what is going on?
Yeah, exactly. What just happened, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
So do you see your hosts taking notes during the show, or they just do it off, just, you know, almost like an emotional reaction kind of, you know, then go into the show, or they were writing down outlines as they're watching the show? Or
yeah, everyone has their, you know, different method of how they take notes. But yeah, for the most part, you know, everything's provided for them, and they, you know, they sit there and they take the notes that works best for them, and off of that they collaborate as a unit, you know, to pick what they're going to fully discuss in terms of topics.
Very interesting.
Do you guys, and I'm assuming then you probably do some sort of a set structure to the beginning of the shows to keep, you know, they have a lineup of what they have to do. I'm just assuming that. Is that true? Or is it each team come up with their own methodology?
Overall, there's a structure, you know, but it's a lot of fill in the blank.
Right.
So, you know, for the various TV shows, and some things, you know, work better for reality shows versus scripted shows and whatever else. And so, you know, sometimes the blanks are, you know, different for whatever genre it is.
You know, Rob, I asked Philip these questions because, you know, I've often long thought that being here in Hawaii, there's some unique opportunities here, not necessarily for an AfterBuzz, but there's some unique opportunities for some media here in Hawaii. And my biggest challenge has been location, 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 trying to get the right location to do something, because it doesn't make sense to do a series of Hawaii-based type of content that'll appeal to not only tourists but also locals that's done in a warehouse. It's, you know, I need to be on the beach, or, you know, with a studio that's facing the beach, and trying to find that type of a space to, you know, that has been a monumental challenge up to this point. But, you know, I've always thought of what would the process be, you know, to scale something where you're doing, and I wasn't even thinking 80 shows. I was thinking like, you know, maybe like 20 hours of programming a week. And that, to me, that was still a, you know, big hurdle. You know, 80 shows with 80 hours of programming a week is wow. Yeah. And I can understand why you need 3 sets to get that done.
Yeah.
So you're all pretty much a night owl group. Does anybody even show up before noon? Or do you have a set team that's there in the morning? Or I can't imagine.
We do have a morning team and a night team. I tend to not sleep much, so I'll sometimes, you know, I'll try to shoot for 10, but sometimes just given my nature, I'll sometimes be here at 9 a.m. And then, you know, typically I'll stay till, you know, let's say 1 a.m. So I don't really sleep much.
Well, you're like me. Up until maybe a few years ago, I lived on 4 hours of sleep for years and years and years, and then now I'm probably 5, 5.5, which is, to me, it seems like I'm wasting time being in bed. But it's actually not good for you. I'll probably die when I'm 70, but you know that.
You had fun for all those years.
Yeah, right? It's life. I didn't miss anything. Being between the sheets, you know.
Yeah.
Philip, I didn't ask you when I was out there, and we didn't really ask you when you first came on here, but what's your official title as part of the AfterBuzz network? Are you like the production manager, or are you kind of like director of all digital operations, or what exactly is your kind of title and role there?
My overall title would be executive producer, you know, for AfterBuzz TV, but as this is growing and as there's the various networks here out of this facility, you know, the title is going to change to basically, you know, digital manager or something like that, where basically my role is to oversee all these networks and the success of these networks and train, you know, the various people for each network to be able to do that, whether it's Black Hollywood Live, whether it's Book Circle, or anything of that.
And we should have asked earlier as well, what's your background in the space, and, you know, what did you do before this?
Ironically, it's film editing. So I got into this, you know, as we started this, we wanted to do this. We didn't really have too much of a background in it. One of the reasons that we did do it was Maria Menounos was very strong in all aspects of entertainment except for digital. And so this was why we, you know, wanted to do it, was to expand, you know, her presence within that, because, you know, we believe that it is the future. And out of necessity, we had no choice but to learn. And, you know, you were talking about how live, you know, demands something different of you and you have to grow with that. You know, this has been exactly that, where it's just demanded so much of out of all of us that, you know, we just had no choice but to learn. And I think, you know, a great quote that I learned early on was, it's not about what you know, it's about what you do when you don't know.
Right.
And people get too hung up on the things that they know. And they pride themselves on that, but then when they're faced with adversity, they don't know what to do. And for us, you know, we've rose to the challenge, I think.
You know, this space is changing so much, you know, and I think about where we've been and, you know, where we're at and where we're going. You know, Rob and I try to keep our ear to the heartbeat of the space and talking with guys like you and really kind of trying to learn what's happening. But, you know, where do you see the space overall going? You know, what's your crystal ball on what's coming, and what do you see as the, you know, the biggest changes since you guys started you know, doing AfterBuzz?
It's certainly been more and more that we live in an on-demand world, and you know, Kevin Onagaro has a theory, everything's moving to mobile, and it's all sort of app-based. So, you know, as everything's on demand, you know, now you can go on your phone and you'll have NBC, you'll have ABC. And so the networks will be splintered in that way. You know, and we try to, I think video is going to grow and grow, as you know, things, you know, there's always that streaming issue. I know mm-hmm. there's still people that, let's say, are early adopters, but they still get, annoyed when things get hung up, you know, and are buffering. I know that's one of Akamai's mission is to have seamless content, no matter, you know, on the go or wherever, you know, and I think there's going to be that blurred line between just how people consume content, whether it's, you know, movies or anything like that. They just can get it anywhere, and it's going to work in that way. I don't know. I don't have some grandmaster, fortunately.
You know, one thing that, you know, I've watched the mobile side of things, and I know you guys got a couple of apps, and, you know, I've been on the fence because I watch the podcast statistics. I know how well, you know, I see where the app growth is coming, or I see how people are consuming, but they're not necessarily consuming, at least in my opinion. And again, I'm looking at a pretty broad spectrum of shows. I don't see individual app usage as high as I would have expected it to be. They use the iOS app of the podcast app within iOS. Of course, the Android community, we've got a whole another issue there with them really not being the space very much. It is an interesting time, and we'll have to see how this all sorts out. I think you guys have the luxury of having a big network and a lot of shows. It makes sense to have an app, but I know these folks that are out there running solo, I don't know how many solo apps I would have on my phone. The network stuff makes sense.
I think for us, you know, it was just to kind of get to know our fans more. And so while not everyone needs our app to listen to the shows, it helps us understand the people a lot more with that, you know, statistically. And what we've seen out of the app is that as great as fans as we have, you know, some people listen up to, let's say, 20 shows of ours, but they still never understood that we do, you know, over 300 in our full roster. And so by having the app, they're almost overwhelmed of like, wow, geez, this is all the shows that you guys do. And so that's been a nice kind of result of having the app out there.
Right.
So, and even though I don't, you know, people aren't necessarily listening to the app, at least now they're more aware and can spread the word that there's all of this content out there.
Yeah, it makes sense. Can you tell me, you know, and it's going to be a segue after we sign off here with you here in a few minutes, but what is your Android ramp? You know, what do you see between iOS users and Android users? Do you have a breakout? Do you know where they're at?
We've sort of been beta testing it, you know, and I think it's iOS is, it, let's say it's 3-1. But we haven't advertised it at all. You know, right now we're kind of working out the kinks. You know, the app is designed by me in terms of the look and the function, and then it's coded by, you know, other people. And so I knew that there was going to be stuff that needed to be fixed. But rather than me go through it and figure out everything that needed to be fixed, you know, we just kind of put it out there, and it's gained traction on its own without any advertisement apart from, you know, as you saw on the website, there's an app button. And we've gotten a lot of great feedback, so we'll be rolling out updates as we go. But I think, as I said, 3-1 for the iOS versus the Android.
Yeah, that's the number.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I think one thing that's going to be interesting to see happen here over the next few years is that, you know, as networks like the AfterBuzz Network or Podcast One or, you know, frankly, the Tech Podcast Network are is the consumption of this medium going to move towards direct relationships with the audience via mobile, via apps versus iTunes and the podcast app on iOS, you know, more first-party services to the OS? Is the audience going to shift over to going more direct than using the big aggregator platforms? And I think that the overall trend does appear to be moving towards people going more direct. But I agree 100% about, you know, individual show apps. I'm not sure that there's a lot of traction there unless you have a huge show. Did you guys ever think about making a separate app for every AfterBuzz show? I mean, was that ever in discussion?
No, not at all. I don't think it would necessarily make sense. And I think, you know, as we're talking about it, in order for an app to work on a, let's say, you know, if you're not necessarily, you know, using the iTunes app, it would have to, there would have to be other content around it, right? So if I can get the same show on the podcast app versus someone else's app, I think there needs to be other features around it, specific to that show that I can get behind, even if it's the smallest little things that I can't necessarily get on the podcast app that would make it work. And I think that will be the success, if at all, of these little other apps.
Well, Rob, we're at the top of the hour here. And do we get any additional questions for Philip before we let him loose here?
No, I think Philip should tell us how our listeners can engage with his platform and his network. That'd be great.
Sure. Definitely check out AfterBuzzTV.com. You know, the second button at the top is shows. So it lists all the shows that we've ever done. You can try search on iTunes directly for one of your favorite TV shows and most likely will pop up. Again, we do have the app on iOS and Android, and youtube.com/AfterBuzzTV.
Very, very cool. Well, we thank you for coming in and to the studio. It sounds like you were maybe coming in anyway, but we definitely appreciate you spending some time with us this morning. And thanks for coming on the show. We do appreciate it.
Well, thank you. It was great. Guys. It was great, you know, getting all the background on this. I think it's going to be very, very interesting to the subscribers to this show, I know.
I agree.
Yep.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
You know, Rob, that... you know, what they're doing over there is pretty incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it is.
Just thinking 80 shows makes my head hurt.
that's why I wanted to go out and spend, I spent like an hour and a half with them in the studio last Wednesday. Just kind of talking through the whole thing of what they're doing out there. You know, there is a close relationship with Podcast One with those guys. But also I was just really curious. I've been following the growth of that network for many years. He said they launched back in 2011. So they're fairly recent in the space, in the scheme of things. But they certainly made an impact very, very quickly, and built quite an operation there.
Yeah, I agree. And it looks to me like now that they've kind of figured it out, I guess that's the better word, that they are going to, you know, it looks like they're going to be definitely pushing into more stuff too.
Oh, yeah.
So,
they're not done, and I'm sure they're going to keep expanding too. So as they get it figured out.
You know, 23 million downloads a week, that's big. That's big. That's probably one of there's not many networks that have more downloads than that.
No.
You know, that's huge.
Not yet anyway, right?
Right. But I would think that would be close to number one. That's got to be very, very close to being number one. I just can't, think.
Well, there's got to be, some other big sports networks and
ESPN,
BBC
does,
and CBC and stuff like that must be doing
pretty well. ESPN
too.
Does well, but they got from a I look at these, I look at ESPN as corporate, I look at AfterBuzz as startup, I put them in the same same categories as, and Leo's not necessarily startup, but I put it in that same kind of genre of shows. I don't want to necessarily discount ESPN and what they're doing, but at the same time, they don't have ESPN dollars to do what they're doing.
Well, they have an advantage of having a big broadcast backbone infrastructure to help boost what they do in the digital side. I think that, that's what's going to be interesting as you look into the future with these big media companies. Is that once they start understanding how to do this stuff, they can leverage both mediums to grow this. You know, the guys like AfterBuzz are starting out pure digital, right?
Right.
They're starting from ground zero, and it's much harder to to build, I think, from ground zero, and it's going to become more difficult to build from ground zero as you look into the future, I think.
Well, it's been an interesting week here for me, just kind of watching the buzz in the space, I guess, for a better word. And, you know, the podcast movement show, the show where we had the podcast movement folks on last week did well. But Rob over at Libsyn posted something on the Google Plus communities yesterday and showing some ratios. Did you see his post?
No, I haven't seen it yet.
So let me bring it up on the screen. And this is what, and this is getting back to the Android discussion. Rob, and here's, let me read this. He says, here's a chart showing the ratio of iOS versus Android downloads across all the shows hosted on Libsyn. This shows the trend for the past 12 months. As you can see, iOS consumption is growing versus that for Android during the past year. So even though there are many more Android devices out there, the end users of those devices seem much less inclined to consume podcasts than those on the iOS side. Clearly, this is what's happening when one platform makes tools for podcast consumption, the other does not. And he says, and just to clarify, 4.2 means 4.2:1 downloads ratio for iOS versus Android. So for every one download to an Android device, there were 4.2 downloads to iOS device for the month of July 2013. So if I look at June, he's got June's numbers here, 5.8 downloads to one. And so if you look at that on a pure, let's just take, you know, if you look at that from a percentage standpoint and do the reverse math on this, so what you really have there is, you know, a whole of 6.8, and divide that by, you know, 100. And so right there, 12-13% is Android share. And it's exactly what we had published from May numbers, is that the actual Android percentage is pretty doggone close between both Libsyn and us. So there's a serious, and we talked about it on the last show, but I just want to continue to reiterate to this audience, we got some work to do.
Well, somebody has some work to do, and it looks to me like it might be Google.
Well, you know, Google's not going to do anything. You know,
I don't disagree with that. But you know, if you look apples to apples, right? I mean, even on Windows Phone here this past week, they pushed out the Windows Phone update, you know, 8.1, which basically wiped out the Zune Podcasts area off of the phone now. So every Windows Phone that got that update no longer has access to the Zune catalog. And they went to a model of a pre-installed app, podcast app. So even on Windows Phone, they're doing like what, kind of even a little bit better than Apple's podcasting app, where the podcast app is pre-installed with the operating system. You know, though Apple has announced that going forward, they're going to have that podcast app be pre-installed. So I think, you know, Android is the one that's not consistent here with the other two platforms in their approach and strategy. And I don't know. I mean, I think it's a big question whether or not a third-party developer can fill that same role that Google could have filled in Android for this.
I don't think they can, but I think it's our job as content creators. If Google's not going to do it, who will? We have to. We have to, as content creators, we have to say, get out there and get an Android app. And
start really promoting it, is what you're saying.
Yeah, start promoting it. So if you're listening now, you need to tell your Android friends to go out and, you know, download one of the podcasting apps on Android. And the one I'm recommending right now is BeyondPod. And largely because they have the biggest share of Android market. They only, you know, of the 13%, BeyondPod has 2.5% of that market. you know, and in this chart that I have is the chart I can continue to show people that, you know, here's the drop off, you know, and it's, I probably should try to blow this thing up, you know, but, you know, if I had a marker here, you can see this is a, this is by percentage of how much.
Yeah.
And it goes iPhone, podcast for iOS, and then Android smartphone as a whole, iPad, Stitcher Radio for iOS, Downcast for iOS, Beyond Pod, Stitcher Radio for Android, Chrome Mobile, ZDN Windows Mobile App, Dog Catcher, Podkicker. And this is new. When you're down here in Podkicker, we're down here in like the less than 1% range already.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know. Do we need to appeal to Apple? I mean, to Google? Do we need to start pounding on their doorsteps and saying, hey, 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 is that going to make a difference?
I don't know. I mean, you know, how do you get the attention of Android users via a third-party app? You know,
well,
I mean, how do you build a similar scenario to Apple's podcast app on Android to have that same kind of presence? You know, that's a multi-year project. That's not going to happen overnight.
No.
And it's going to be, well, I don't know. I mean, I honestly don't know how you do that.
You know, iOS has got a 10-year head start.
Yeah.
Actually, nine year.
Now, granted, I think that the whole podcast community, I think, needs to rally around this issue.
Yeah.
And I think that it would clearly help. But the problem is that most of the listeners, like we all know, are on iOS. You know?
But the reason they're on iOS, it's easy. You know,
But the podcast community promoting it to iOS users is not going to help. Is what I'm saying.
Right. And I keep having, you know, and I was guilty of it myself on my show, not talking about, you know, Android apps, you know, and it's maybe something we've kind of like, uh-oh, you know, we need to regroup here. And I'm going to keep hammering it, and hopefully people will listen. You know, Rob is obviously seeing the trend. We're seeing it.
Yep.
You know, and if you know, in all honesty, if we could get the Android ecosystem equal to the iOS ecosystem, even if we just could just bring the number of folks that are using iOS up to the same level they're using Android, or even half, it would be monumental growth for the space.
Yeah.
It would be, you know, we would have the, you know, maybe even it would be the biggest year of growth we'd ever see, you know,
yeah.
And growth equals bigger attention, bigger eyeballs on the space, more money being invested, more advertisers, you name it.
Yep.
So really what's happening right now is Google and Windows is causing stagnation in the podcasting space. Surprise, surprise.
Well, I can stand up and raise my hand and say I'm working on this project at Podcast One. I'm trying to get our apps in top shape, and one of my core targets is Android. You know, we're a long ways, you know, away from being that app. But you know, it's definitely a focus of mine to push that direction, to become much better over there, and hopefully we can bring to bear some marketing to promote Android as a place to get podcasting. And I think it's definitely a topic we need to keep talking about on this show. And I think we need to talk about it a lot at Podcast Movement, and maybe make some suggestions to the community about what we can do. You know, how to differentiate Android as a terrific place to, you know, get podcasts. I don't know. I mean, do you have any ideas on what we might be able to do?
Well, you know, I know what I'm going to do. And I know what we have been doing is, you know, we've got at least, and this goes, I don't want this to be self-serving, but we're expanding the Blueberry directory. We're going to probably be adding 40,000 to 50,000 shows to the site over the next month and a half. and trying to have a complete active directory of shows that are basically being produced on a weekly basis, or, you know, on a basically an active basis. And we've got an API. So if there's any app developers out there saying, I got a great idea for an app, but I have no way, I don't want to build the back end to feed it. We can help you with that. We've got an API which you could basically use our directory to pre-populate your, you know, your directory database. And I don't want to be the end all for all, but if we don't do it, no one's going to do it. And I, you know, I want an app that's, you know, inclusive, not exclusive, that it really has everyone. And I think that's, you know, that's, it's, you know, it's going to have to grow critical mass here. And there's really only, if Google's not going to do it, then, or if Windows isn't going to do it, you know, what we really should be doing is screaming bloody murder to Google, and we should be screaming to Windows. So obviously they don't care because they removed what functionality there was out of it.
Well, they do have a new app. I mean, I do have to give them credit. They do have a new podcast, dedicated podcast app, which definitely puts them in a position of being able to update that, improve that, make changes to it outside of an OS update, which I think is what they were trying to accomplish. And I think, but we did take one step forward in one hand and like three steps back on the other side.
So have you been able to add shows to this new app? Have you been able to make it happen where you can easily find the shows that you're subscribed to?
It's my experience with it. It's rather hit and miss. And back when a couple of years ago, when they were talking about taking this approach, I was very blunt with them about what the implications of that were.
Right.
But they didn't have an alternative. And that was the best approach that they could think of under the current, kind of leadership decisions at the company. And, you know, I have to be honest, it's one of the reasons I left the company was because I knew what was coming, and I just couldn't, you know, I just couldn't stay there and be involved in that. So,
you know, and it's obvious, you know, Microsoft has, they on their Xbox exclusive content team, they've decimated that. I think there was 200 people or so that were laid off. I think there's maybe a handful left down there in their LA office. Their Xbox content strategy, in my opinion, has failed. I don't know what, I don't know if Microsoft has gotten too big. How come they're so, in my opinion, so far out of touch with what's going on in the media space? You know, and it's in that, and they're not the only ones. So, you know, everyone's worried. It wants to. We got to have streaming radio stations, but when it comes to a content strategy beyond YouTube or beyond a handful of partners, their view is pretty narrow.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of speculation and conversation over the last week because of the recent layoffs, right?
Right.
But I think that there's also a lot of misunderstanding about what really happens when this stuff happens at a company like this, because I've been through it personally before. I didn't really say this in the past, but my role as the podcast manager at the company was cut back in 2009. So I was part of the last big layoff that happened at the company. And I can tell you exactly personally how that process happened and how it worked, because I personally went through it. So when a company, you know, when Microsoft specifically announces layoffs like this, it is a little bit of a unique situation because it involves, you know, 25,000 Nokia employees that were kind of, you know, absorbed as with the acquisition. So it is a little bit different, but if you're an existing Microsoft employee and you're in good standing, right, you know, like you had a fairly good last year review and all this kind of stuff, and they decide to cut your position, right? It's basically an FDE role, right, that has been tasked with a certain job title and a certain role in an organization. They basically eliminate the job. They don't lay anybody. They don't fire anybody. It doesn't work that way. What they actually do is they tell you that your role has been eliminated and that you have 6 weeks to find a new role. And if you don't find a new role in the company in 6 weeks, then yeah, you are basically, you know, not working at the company anymore. And that's basically the process that I went through. And I didn't find a new role, but I came back within 6 weeks as a contractor in the same job.
Right.
As managing podcasts. Because the day that I was told that I was laid off, I basically talked to my GM, and my GM told me that they were going to hire me back in a couple of weeks doing the same job because that job still needed to be done. But they had to eliminate the FDE role. So what you're saying is a lot of those people that got laid off supposedly could be brought back into the company in a different role where they have a need, right? But not everybody's going to come back, but it's going to be some subset of those. And the other big thing that came out, also, and it hadn't been discussed, it really hasn't been discussed much in the media at all, is contract workers and contingent workers, which is about half of the staffing at the company is contingent workers. Those are folks that are under 1 year or 6 or 9 month contract. And there was a lot of those folks that are let go. And those folks, you just get called into the office with your manager, or and they just tell you that next week you're done, you know, and you're gone. And Microsoft doesn't have to report those layoffs. So it's, you know, there's a lot of that going on too. So, and then they changed the rules around contractors too. You can only work for 18 months in a straight contract before you have to take a 6 month break from being able to work at the company.
Wow.
So that's a fairly new policy. I was actually in a contract role twice at the company managing podcasts that went multi-year. I was under the same contract. I mean, it did not have an end date. I didn't have to take an exit. So that's what the V-dash, there was speculation about V-dash and A-dash contractors. A-dash contractors are under this kind of this more limited, or have been under this more limited work window that you have to take, you know, like 100 days off. That's been the past. But the V-dash, they're basically unlimited contracts. So each year the company has the option to renew you. So you're really, for all intents and purposes, you're really an employee of the company. It's just that you're not officially an employee of the company.
But are you getting a check from Microsoft or from a third-party
contractor? Third-party contractor, but you're under contract with that third-party company that has the contract with Microsoft.
Yep.
So you're basically an independent contractor, but I was an employee of this third-party company that got benefits and just almost identical to what I had with Microsoft. So it's this very complex stuff that they do with these layoffs that isn't well understood in the media.
The government does that a lot too, because what they'll do is they'll have regular government employees, which are more expensive in the long run, whereas you always hear about all these government contractors. Well, there's a reason they have government contractors. They need them for a short time or a set period, and they get rid of them or cancel the contract, and they don't have a lifetime overhead commitment to that particular individual. And that's where the person is, you know, that's why 401ks came into play, is this, the guy's contributing to 401k with his company or whatever investment plan they have. And then, you know, oftentimes what will happen is, and it's stuff I've seen when, you know, in the past, is that, you know, a company gets a new company has basically won the contract. So what will happen is, in mass, the entire group of people that were working under one contract are all given new job offers, and they move to the new contracting company and are on for however long that contract is. But you know, really working as a contractor, you get screwed because you lose vacation days. You have to start the bottom of the totem pole again. Oftentimes the salary might be a little bit different. You may miss a pay increase cycle. There's all kinds of crap that happens as being a contractor versus a direct employee. But even this round where they took 13,000 or whatever the number is going to be of direct employees or Blue Badgers are going to be told to hit the road with a severance package.
Well, those, I mean, the 13,000 that you're talking about were Nokia employees. So they were just brought in as part of the company. And a lot of them were kind of like manufacturing. So Nokia has manufacturing facilities all around the world that made their phones, right? Microsoft has their own manufacturing deals in China and other places to make Xbox and to make other devices, right? So the company already has infrastructure to manufacture already, right? Because they're already doing that. Most of it's outsourced. So if you think about Nokia, Nokia owned all their manufacturing. So there would be a certain amount of cost savings and redundancy that would exist between Nokia's manufacturing and the existing infrastructure that Microsoft already had. So you think about the staffing that supports all that. They had to let that go, and that was part of the huge cost savings.
But they did get rid of some Microsoft employees as well. I saw some.
Correct.
Yeah,
correct.
I don't know what that total number is, or mainline Microsoft folks.
Yeah, I heard it was about, in the Seattle market, it was about 1,300 people were actually let go. And I would say, just based on my past experience, that probably less than half of those will actually lose their jobs.
Wow.
They'll more likely get a different job, because typically what happens is this is a shift of chairs, right? It's like a bunch of jobs were eliminated, but a bunch of other jobs were created as part of this shift. And so some of those people will be able to make that shift and others won't.
Yep.
And that's how it really works in the background. So it's oftentimes not as severe as people think it is. But I do think that the contractor side layoffs, I think, is the most significant, because they announced that they were going to be eliminating 20% of the contractors over the next 5 years. So that's where the layoffs are happening.
You know, one thing too is that, you know, a lot of these people that are being laid off, they have some skills. So it's not like they're going to be non-marketable. You know, I'm sure all the programmers that were in that group, if there were any programmers that were laid off.
I'm sure there were, but small amount.
Yeah. They're going to be able to find work immediately. And they're probably right in the Seattle area. They probably won't have to go too far, because there's such a huge demand.
Yeah.
Now, they may not have the same benefits package, or maybe they make the same kind of money, maybe not. But I don't think they're going to go hungry.
No, I don't think so. So, I mean, it's most of the layoffs that happen are usually centered around like business development and marketing and program management, and not so much engineers per se, because those are very valuable people to have in the company. And that's another thing that's really interesting about the shift in CEO is that the current CEO there now is an engineer.
Right.
You know, it's a much more of an engineering driven company, and I believe that that's part of the reason why you saw the cut in the entertainment side with Xbox Studios and all those. You know, I work very closely with people that form that division. And I totally understand the friction, the internal friction that exists around content at that company. It was a struggle back in the Zune days. It was always a struggle in Xbox. The company just doesn't want to be in the content business. It wants to be an engineering company. And that's where its skill sets are. That's typically where its leadership has an understanding. It's just not a content company, and they run down the path, but then they bail at some point if it gets difficult or it gets tough, and they're not making money as much as they want. Then they're very quick to pull the plug on it. And that's exactly what happened here.
Well, this country's a lot of the business today is revolving around, you know, mobile. You look at $2 billion Apple paid out to its, folks from its app store. Google paid out more, but there's also, when you look at the ratios, the reason is because there's more Android apps, but Apple users are very much more valuable than Android users when it comes to buying stuff. So, and I think part of it is the buy experience on Android is not as nice.
Well, I think that, you know, I think we're also seeing a shift towards lower end smartphones now too that cater to, you know, a less kind of resource, you know, available demographic.
Right,
you know,
right.
I know that's what that was a lot of the big announcements that have been coming out about Windows Phone is offering phones that are, you know, that you can sell in other markets that are like $99. You know, trying to get that price point down, trying to get smartphone features into what's been kind of feature phone type markets.
Right.
And I think that's where the growth is right now. It's not in, you know, Lumia 1520 quad core 6-inch phones. I mean, that's not where the growth in the smartphone market is today.
Right.
But yet on the other side of the coin, from a content perspective, you know, I agree, you know, anybody can consume podcasts. You don't have to be a high-end iPhone user to enjoy podcasts.
That's a good thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things that could be holding it back is maybe the content isn't there that will attract that other demographic that typically has not been a podcast listener up to this point.
Right.
I know that's one aspect that Podcast One's working on trying to build other genres of content that haven't been typically successful.
Well, Rob, we're here in an hour and a half and I need to wrap here. And I've actually got another interview today. I got, all of a sudden it's like interview season. Everyone wants to interview. It's kind of weird, but I got an interview here in 30 minutes. What do we have on tap for next week?
I have Mike Chaffee, who's going to join us. He's one of the leading lights with the Corolla Digital Network with the Mr. Adam Carolla show.
Oh, that's going to be great.
Mike's been on the New Media Show before.
Yeah.
But I wanted to have him on to kind of talk a little bit about podcast networks and things like that. It's the topic that we're going to be covering at the Podcast Movement event.
Yep.
You know, I think there's some discussion out there about, you know, joining a podcast network is a bad thing and you shouldn't do it. And I just think it'd be great to kind of set the stage for what we're going to do at the event. And Mike, I initially invited Mike to join us on the panel and he can't make it. But, it'd be great to have him on to talk about that. And maybe he can bring us up to date on what's going on with Corolla Digital. And I know he's involved heavily in the efforts on the part of Adam Carolla to raise awareness for the patent troll. You know, he's raising money. That case is still pending here. I don't believe that he can say much about it because he's involved in it.
Right.
But you know, he can at least tell us, you know, what Adam Carolla is doing to raise money in his campaign to fight it. So anyway.
Very cool. Well, if you have comments on today's show, it's real easy to reach out to either Rob or I. You can do it todd@newmediashow.com or rob@newmediashow.com. And Rob, we weren't quite ready. Angelo didn't get the template done. He's Sunday, he says, I'll have something to work with.
Wow, awesome.
But I've been told that a couple times already. So
I know how that goes.
So we are ready to make the switch when we have the template, and we'll be talking about that, hopefully, knock on wood, on the next show. But everyone, thanks for being here and being part of our small family of podcast and new media creators. And look forward to having you back with us next week with another edition of the New Media Show. Everyone, take care. Thank you so much. We'll see you next
time.
Take
care. Thanks.